What if the revolutionary safety feature, keeping you alive in a car crash, is actually just a mathematical rounding error?
Yeah, it sounds crazy, but it really is one of the most fascinating cases of scientific mistaken identity in modern metallurgy.
Right, because for decades, the automotive engineering world has completely rallied around this highly celebrated class of shape-shifting metal.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they've designed entire manufacturing processes around it.
Yeah, built predictive models for it and basically trusted it to absorb massive kinetic energy on the highway.
But we're looking at a scenario where an entire industry became so captivated by a beautifully complex microscopic anomaly.
That they miss the actual mechanics.
Exactly. They completely missed the fundamental continuum mechanics driving the material's performance.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, our mission is to investigate exactly how a massive sector of materials science was led completely astray by really elegant theory.
We are unpacking a brilliant, frankly disruptive 2002 paper by HKDH Padacia from the University of Cambridge.
And it has a very provocative title, right? Trip-assisted steels, with a question mark at the end.
Yes, that question mark is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
It really is. So we are looking at the drive to reduce automobile weight using high-strength steels.
Steels that don't sacrifice ductility, meaning they can bend without breaking.
Right, which brings us directly to trip-assisted steels. Okay, let's unpack this. The acronym TRIP.
Stands for Transformation-Induced Plasticity.
Right. And the baseline industry wisdom has long been that this specific steel gets its phenomenal ductility because a portion of its microstructure literally undergoes a phase transformation while under stress.
A martensitic phase transformation specifically.
Yeah, so it absorbs kinetic energy by changing its internal crystal lattice.
That is the core premise of the Trippet effect. And you can totally see why the industry embraced it.
Because it sounds amazing on paper.
Well, yeah, it presents a highly dynamic solution to the classic trade-off between strength and ductility.
Yeah.
Manufacturers saw these steels performing exceptionally well during aggressive stamping processes.
And in high-impact crash tests, right?
Exactly. And they universally attributed that macro-scale success to this localized, flashy, microscopic phase change.
But Padacci's paper takes a step back.
It does. Instead of just observing the microstructure, he decides to rigorously, mathematically test the geometric constraints of that transformation.
And what the calculations reveal is a massive discrepancy between the established narrative and the physical reality of the metal.
A massive discrepancy.
But before we get to the math that dismantles that narrative, we need to establish the exact metallurgical parameters we are dealing with.
Right, the microscopic recipe.
Because we need to look at the precise chemical composition and the resulting phase distribution. This isn't just, a generic low-carbon alloy.
Far from it. The baseline composition we're analyzing is iron with 0.15% carbon, minus 1.5% silicon, and 1.5% manganese by weight.
And that specific elemental ratio is basically non-negotiable,
It's
right?
totally non-negotiable. It's engineered to produce a very deliberate multi-phase microstructure.
And according to the paper, that microstructure breaks down into three primary constituents.
Right.
The bulk matrix is allotriomorphic ferrite. Then you have bainitic ferrite making up roughly 20% of the volume.
And finally, you have the remaining 10%, which is the famous retained austenite.
The magic ingredient.
Allegedly, yes. Now, the fact that we have 10% austenite persisting at ambient room temperature is it's a thermodynamic balancing act.
Because austenite usually decomposes into other phases as steel cools down, doesn't it?
As you know, it typically does.
Yeah.
But this is where that 1.5% silicon becomes absolutely critical.
Okay, what does the silicon do?
Well, silicon has exceptionally low solubility in cementite. So during the intermediate cooling stages, when the upper bainite is growing,
Right.
the high silicon concentration effectively suppresses the precipitation of cementite.
Ah, I see. So because the silicon acts as a barrier to cementite formation, the carbon that's being rejected by the growing bainitic ferrite has to find somewhere else to go.
Precisely. It partitions directly into the residual austenite.
So it enriches it.
Yes, that localized carbon enrichment chemically stabilizes the remaining austenite. It depresses the martensite start temperature well below room temperature.
So you end up with this highly enriched, metastable austenite permanently trapped in the microstructure.
Just waiting for an external mechanical trigger to force it to transform.
Okay, I follow the thermodynamics, but I really have to push back on the overarching design philosophy here.
Go ahead.
We have this highly engineered composite, right? mostly allotriomorphic ferrite, 20% bainite, and just 10% retained austenite.
Correct.
Why did the materials science community decide that this mere 10% volume fraction was the definitive magic ingredient responsible for the steel's massive uniform elongation? I mean, it's a tiny minority of the overall structure.
What's fascinating here is how the visual evidence from electron microscopy heavily biased the engineering community.
They just trusted what they saw, basically, yeah. When you apply stress to this microstructure, that 10% of metastable austenite undergoes a displacive martensitic transformation, the shapeshift.
Exactly. It's a sudden, violent structural metamorphosis. And because it's so dynamic and visually striking under a microscope, researchers naturally assumed it was the primary mechanism absorbing the strain energy.
Ah, so it became a classic correlation versus causation error.
Exactly. The transformation was happening during deformation, so they just assumed it was driving the deformation.
But to prove that's an error, we can't just look at it. We have to calculate the physical geometry of what that transformation actually contributes to the metal's length.
Right. We have to do the math.
How does a microscopic lattice shift mathematically translate into macro-scale axial elongation?
To bridge that gap between the micro and macro, we really have to analyze the specific mechanics of a displacive phase change.
Okay.
Unlike a diffusional transformation where atoms slowly migrate and rearrange, the austenite to martensite shift is a coordinated military-style movement of atoms.
So they all move at once.
Yes. This synchronized lattice deformation is mathematically characterized as an invariant plane strain.
Okay. Let's visualize the geometry of that invariant plane strain. Imagine you've got a perfectly aligned deck of playing cards.
I like that analogy.
So the displacive transformation applies two distinct dimensional changes to this volume. First, there's a substantial shear component.
Right, with shear.
The paper identifies the shear value, which is denoted as is at approximately 0.26, occurring parallel to the habit plane.
Yes.
So if you press your hand flat on the top of the deck of cards and push forward, sliding the card so the entire deck leans aggressively to one side, that represents the shear.
That deck of cards is a great way to visualize the macro effect of the shear. But remember, we're talking about an atomic lattice structure. So this deformation is happening uniformly across the crystalline plane.
Right. It's happening at a microscopic level. And as you noted, there is a second component to the invariant plane strain.
Yes, the dilatation.
Right. The volumetric expansion. The mathematical value for the dilatation is about 0.03, and it occurs normal to the habit plane.
So it's expanding outward.
Yeah. So while our deck of cards is shearing sideways, the spacing between the cards is simultaneously expanding, making the entire deck slightly thicker.
Exactly. You have a highly localized region within the steel that simultaneously shears diagonally and expands outward.
Okay.
Now, in a fully austenitic grain, when a generalized stress is applied, there are 24 possible crystallographic variants.
Meaning 24 different three-dimensional orientations in which this martensite deformation can manifest.
Right, which means there are 24 different trajectories that microscopic shear could potentially take.
Okay, but in an industrial application like a standard uniaxial tensile test, we aren't looking for random multi-directional expansion.
No, definitely not.
We want to maximize the uniform elongation along one specific axis, the direction we are actually pulling.
The physics of continuum mechanics dictate that the applied tensile stress will have the maximum interaction with the shape deformation only when the vectors align perfectly.
So they have to match up.
Specifically, the tensile axis, the habit plane normal, and the shear direction must all lie in the same plane.
So we need optimal geometric alignment to extract the maximum possible physical stretch out of that invariant plane strain.
Yes. And Badeshi utilizes those specific values, the 0.26 shear and the 0.03 dilatation, to calculate the theoretical maximum efficiency of this transformation.
And what's the result?
When you resolve the shear and dilatation vectors against the tensile axis, the mathematical optimum angle between the tensile axis and the habit plane normal calculates to exactly 42 degrees.
42 degrees. That is the mathematical sweet spot.
Yep.
If the crystals align perfectly at that angle, the phase transformation yields its absolute maximum contribution to the elongation of the steel.
That's the theory.
So if 42 degrees is the absolute optimal alignment for this shape shifting, what happens when we try to replicate that theoretical maximum in a real-world testing machine?
This is where Badeshi's calculations really begin to dismantle the TRAP narrative. Let's assume a highly idealized, basically physically impossible scenario.
Okay, I'm with you.
Imagine a tensile specimen composed of 100% pure austenite.
Pure austenite, got it.
Now assume that under tension, Every single grain magically transforms into the single most favorable variant out of the 24 possibilities.
Perfectly aligned at that 42-degree angle. The ultimate best-case scenario for the cheap hyperthick.
Exactly. Even under those absolutely perfect conditions, the theoretical maximum uniform tensile elongation you can achieve purely from the phase transformation is capped.
Capped at what?
At approximately 15%.
Wait, if the lattice is violently shearing at an S value of 0.26, why is the macroscale axial elongation hitting a hard ceiling at 15%?
It comes down to the boundary constraints of the testing environment.
The machine itself.
Yeah. In a uniaxial tensile test, as the internal lattice undergoes that massive shear, it tries to physically displace the ends of the specimen laterally.
It tries to push them sideways.
But the massive, rigid steel grips of the testing machine prohibit any lateral movement.
Oh, wow.
Because the grips force the ends of the sample to remain coaxial, the macroscopic shear actually forces the entire gauge section of the specimen to physically rotate relative to the tensile axis.
Ah, I see. As the specimen rotates to accommodate the rigid grips, the internal crystal lattice is rotating along with it.
Precisely. That rotation rapidly shifts the habit plane and the shear direction away from that optimal 42-degree alignment.
It ruins the alignment.
It does. As the orientation deviates from the optimum, the transformation's mechanical contribution to the axial elongation drops off exponentially.
And that's what effectively caps the net strain at that 15% threshold.
You got it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because 15% is the absolute maximum stretch for a specimen that is 100% pure austenite.
Right.
But we already established the chemical reality of commercial trip-assisted steels. They are predominantly ferrite.
They only contain about 10% retained austenite by volume.
The implications of the math become very clear at this point.
Very clear.
Wait, so if we take the 15% maximum theoretical stretch...
Under physically impossible perfect conditions.
Right. And factor in that the steel is only 10% austenite. 15% multiplied by a 0.1 zirium fraction yields a total elongation contribution of exactly 1.5%.
That's the number.
That math completely contradicts the industry claims. The paper notes that standard trip-assisted steels routinely exhibit a total uniform tensile strain of 15 to 30%.
They do.
Yet the actual transformation-induced plasticity, the namesake mechanism of the entire alloy class, only mathematically accounts for 1.5% of that performance.
It is a stunning realization.
It's crazy.
Depending on slight variations in austenite volume, the contribution might range from 0.75% to 2.25%, but it averages to a negligible rounding error.
Rounding error.
And remember, that 1.5% figure still assumes optimal variant selection.
Which doesn't happen in reality.
No. In a real polycrystalline piece of steel, those 24 variants nucleate randomly based on localized stress concentrations.
Which means the shear strains are pointing in all different directions.
Exactly. When variant formation is random, the massive shear components, the sliding decks of cards, often act in opposing directions.
Yeah, they fight each other.
They physically cancel each other out on a macroscopic level. That leaves only the tiny 0.03 dilatation component to contribute to the overall volume change.
Meaning the actual strain contribution from the Trippi effect is likely a fraction of that 1.5%.
A tiny fraction.
This raises a massive, unavoidable question.
Oh, let's hear it.
If the vaunted trip phase transformation only contributes a microscopic fraction of a percent to the elongation, how is the steel actually stretching 30% before fracturing?
It's the million-dollar question.
We know the steel works. It performs beautifully in deep drawing applications and crash structures. So where is the other 28% of the plasticity coming from?
To find the real micromechanical engine driving that performance, we have to stop staring at the 10% austenite.
Okay, look away from the flashy phase change.
And look at how the other 90% of the phases interact. The true mechanism responsible for the profound uniform elongation is something called composite deformation behavior.
So what does this all mean in terms of continuum mechanics? How do allotriomorphic ferrite and bainite interact differently than a uniform microstructure?
It requires analyzing the divergent mechanical properties of the constituent phases. First, you have the allotriomorphic ferrite matrix.
The soft part.
Right. Ferrite is inherently soft. It has a low yield strength, denoted as SY, and a low initial strain hardening coefficient, or in value.
But it has high ductility.
Yes, massive intrinsic ductility, or U.
So it yields early and accommodates a massive amount of plastic strain.
Conversely, you have the hard phase, which is the bainitic ferrite, along with any martensite that forms.
And the hard phase behaves differently.
Very differently. It exhibits a high yield strength, a very high strain hardening coefficient, but drastically lower ductility.
So if we load this multi-phase composite under tension, how does the applied strain partition between those two extremes?
It operates entirely on the principle of local stress thresholds. When the macroscopic stress is applied, the deformation does not distribute uniformly.
It favors the weak link.
The much softer ferrite matrix yields first. It begins to strain plastically, while the hard bainite remains purely elastic.
Oh, I see.
But as the ferrite deforms, it undergoes intense work hardening. The generation and entanglement of dislocations within the ferrite lattice steadily increase its flow stress.
So the soft phase is acting as a massive strain sink.
Exactly.
It's absorbing the initial kinetic energy, but in doing so, it is locally hardening itself, increasing its resistance to further deformation.
Exactly. And this is the critical micromechanical transfer point. The ferrite work hardens until its local flow stress elevates to match the inherent yield strength of the adjacent hard bainite.
And then what happens?
Once those thresholds intersect, the harder phase is dynamically forced to begin co-deforming.
So what does this all mean? It's kind of like a tag team wrestling match or a relay race.
How so?
The soft, flexible wrestler takes the initial beating, exhausting the opponent, the stress, and only when they can't take any more, they tag in the heavy hitter.
The hard phase.
Right. The hard phase who has saved all their energy for the final stretch. This is a brilliant, natural load balancing system.
It really is.
Instead of the whole material yielding and necking at once, the soft ferrite takes the early strain, hardens, and then effectively forces the stress to bridge over into the harder phases.
Which have retained all of their inherent ductility because they remained elastic during the early stages.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it makes total sense.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this delayed progressive activation of the hard phases prevents localized necking.
It keeps the material stretching smoothly.
By continuously shifting the plastic strain between phases of differing stiffness, you sustain a high aggregate strain hardening rate over a vastly extended range of deformation.
Wow.
It is the complex composite interaction between the soft and hard phases that drives the 30% elongation, not the localized phase change of the austenite.
The paper backs this up beautifully by citing the control studies performed by Jacques and his colleagues, right?
Yes, the Jacques et al. Research.
They essentially ran an experiment that stripped the magic out of the steel to see what would happen.
That research is the definitive proof of Padescia's mathematical model. Remember that the 1.5% silicon was required to suppress cementite and stabilize the retained austenite.
Yeah, without the silicon, the austenite wouldn't survive.
Well, Jacques deliberately developed low silicon variations of these multi-phase steels. By reducing the silicon, they allowed cementite to precipitate during the bainitic hold, which starved the austenite of carbon.
Which means the austenite either decomposed or wasn't stable enough to be retained at room temperature.
They effectively eliminated the capacity for the true P effect.
So they tested a multi-phase steel with virtually no retained austenite.
And the results were completely counter to the industry narrative.
I bet.
These low-silicon austenite-depleted steels still exhibited uniform elongation metrics that vastly outperformed standard commercial high-strength steels.
They matched the performance of the highly alloyed 3P variants.
Because the elytriomorphic ferrite and the bainite were still there, executing that dynamic load transfer and work hardening process.
The composite deformation was functioning perfectly without the phase transformation.
The retained austenite was merely a spectator.
A very flashy spectator.
Exactly. It was transforming under stress, looking highly dynamic under a microscope. But mechanically, it was practically irrelevant to the macroscopic tensile properties.
So to synthesize this entire investigation, we started with a highly celebrated, globally implemented class of automotive steel.
Named specifically for transformation-induced plasticity.
Right. We looked at the micromechanics of displacive invariant plane strain, calculating the optimal 42-degree variant alignment.
We explored how the physical constraints of macroscopic testing grips force the specimen to rotate.
rigidly capping the theoretical strain at 15%. And when we multiplied that by the 10% volume fraction of austenite, we revealed that the namesake phase transformation contributes barely 1.5% to the metal's massive flexibility.
Barely a percent and a half.
Ultimately, we discovered that the real mechanical heavy lifting is being done by the continuous dynamic stress partitioning between the soft ferrite matrix and the harder bainite phases.
It is a masterclass in why rigorous mathematical modeling must always verify observational assumptions.
Absolutely.
Which leaves us with a rather profound question regarding human bias in engineering.
Let's hear it.
If a multi-billion-dollar industrial sector designing the very materials that protect us in high-speed impacts can universally name an alloy class after a visual anomaly that amounts to a 1.5% mathematical rounding error.
Yeah.
We have to ask ourselves how many other established principles or revolutionary technologies in our modern infrastructure are fundamentally misnamed.
That's a scary thought.
Are we systematically ignoring the quiet foundational mechanisms doing the actual work simply because we are too distracted by the microscopic fireworks?
That is exactly the kind of question that makes you look at the world differently. The next time you rely on a perfectly engineered piece of technology, remember that the flashy feature everyone talks about might just be a distraction from the underlying physics actually keeping things together. Keep questioning the consensus.